हरे ओ सहनावतु सहनाभुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Nyaya provides a few arguments to establish the theory of God. The first is the causal argument. According to this line of reasoning, the entire universe is formed by the combination of atoms, mountains, fields, rivers, and so on. Must have a cause, for they are made up of parts, possess limited dimensions, and are not intelligent. This being so, they cannot be the cause of themselves. They require the guidance of an intelligent cause. That intelligent cause must have direct knowledge of all matter and of the atoms that underlie all matter. He must be omnipresent and omniscient. This intelligent entity cannot be the individual soul because the knowledge of the soul is limited. A soul, for instance, does not have the knowledge of other souls. Therefore, there must be an ultimate intelligent entity who is termed God. The second argument is based on adrishta, which means the unseen or the unknown, and may be translated as providence or fate. The philosophers of the Nyaya system inquire as to why some people are happy and others are not. Why are some wise and others ignorant? One cannot say that there is no cause, because every event has a cause. The causes of pain and pleasure must therefore be one's own actions in this life or in previous lives. People enjoy or suffer according to the merits or demerits produced by their past good or bad actions. This law of karma, which governs the life of every individual soul, requires that every human being must reap the fruits of his own actions. There is often a long interval of time between an action and its effect, however, and many pleasures and sorrows cannot be traced to any action performed in this life. Likewise, many actions performed in this life do not produce fruits immediately. The subtle impressions of all one's actions persist long after the actions themselves, and are collected in the soul in the form of credits or merits, punya, and deficiencies or demerits, papa. The sum total of all merits and demerits that are accrued from good and bad actions is called adrishta, fate, and this produces present pain and pleasure. Adrishta is not an intelligent principle, however, and it cannot inspire its own fructification. It must therefore be guided or directed by some intelligent agent to produce the proper consequences. The individual soul cannot be said to be the director or controller of adrishta, because souls do not know anything about their adrishta. Thus, the almighty intelligent agent who guides or directs adrishta through the proper channels to produce the proper consequences is the eternal, omnipotent, omnipresent supreme being termed God. A third Nyaya argument Okay, he mentions that it looks like two more arguments, so there must be five arguments. But he puts it in footnotes. Two more arguments for the existence of God are found in Nyaya. The argument from language and arts, and the argument from number. The first maintains that language and arts originated in God. An artist is moved by the highest ideal of beauty and perfection, and these are in God. For God is the embodiment of truth, beauty, and goodness. Similarly, God is the creator of language. He is the denotive power of words. He is also the cause of convention, Shanketa. The argument from number asserts that dyads, triads, and the like have magnitude because they are substances, and all substances have magnitude. The atomic magnitude and the large magnitude are contraries of each other and as such cannot produce each other. The magnitude of dyad is caused by the number of atoms. Thus the magnitude of a dyad depends upon the duality of the constituent atoms which comprise it. And this duality depends upon the intellect of God, who alone is omniscient and conscious of the atoms. Thus God not only produces motion, kriya, in the atoms by will, bringing them together and produces dyads, triads, and the like, but also thinks of the numbers, duality, and the like, which brings about the magnitudes. All right, so you have, so in other words, you have the element that, because what is being expressed in art is one's only taking it from the beauty that is manifest in nature. So that beauty, so God being the source of that beauty, you know, means, in other words, all beauty has its, people appreciate beauty, right? So then that would mean that that has to be coming from somewhere, because the tree is not generating the beauty. The nature is not generating the beauty. It's not thinking, I am beautiful. Therefore, I'll look this way or that way. They just inherently have their way of looking. Therefore, that beauty, because of that lack of intelligence, they aren't creating the beauty. That means it has to be coming from someone higher. You know what I'm saying? So that beauty then, and perfection, they are in God, right? So all the nice things, beautiful things, wonderful things that are inspiring the artist, then that has to be coming from him. It won't be coming from somewhere else. And then from numbers, then you have the, magnitude or their volume or their, you know, what's, presence that they'll have, greater or smaller, right? So then, so everything that has a substance has some magnitude, right? Some volume, some intensity is there. Now, because of the opposites of these elements within something, they're contradictory. They can't be creating the other, right? So then the difficulty comes up is that then that would mean that someone else would have to be operating them, because the atoms themselves aren't conscious. God would have to be operating them. Right? You see the point? So, in other words, all the things in the creation, except the soul, are not conscious. So someone else has to be creating them. So the creation of the world and everything that we see, creation of everything that we consider is wonderful within it. Right? In other words, there's the creation itself, just the matter. Then there's that interest and attraction and everything we have for it. That has to come from somewhere else. Right? Then you have the point of karma. Karma is so elaborate in that, but karma itself can't be directing itself. It's also not alive. So that has to be coming from somewhere else. The souls themselves can't be the cause of it because they're unconscious of everything. So they can't be what's there. And then, these atoms and everything that we're dealing with, then they themselves also are directed and put together by the Lord. Right? So the atoms into the forms into the creation. Right? But it will be noted here that nowhere is it mentioning that God is the source of the souls. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't say he's the source of these things. He's the creator in that he puts everything together and takes everything apart. This is the weakness in the philosophy. Like that. Then the last argument for the existence of God is based on scriptural testimony. According to this reasoning, the Veda, Upanishads, and all other authoritative scriptures state the existence of God. These scriptures were not written by common people, but were formulated by those great sages who experienced truth from within. Thus, the authority of testimony depends on direct experience, which is the only source of knowledge about any and all facts. The fact of the existence of God is experienced directly by individual souls, and some of these individuals have expressed their God realizations. The Veda expresses such direct experiences of God, therefore God exists. Right. Now in here, it's important to note here that now this works out the difficulty between the inference and the direct, and the, pratyaksha or perception, is that they're taking it, that direct experience, the direct perception from it, either the perception that is gained by being able to see something indirectly, or that one is able to tell by some experience. Right? These alone are, you could say, facts. Right? Then from inference, then working with facts, then from one set of facts you can understand another set of facts. You understand? But it all still goes back to that perception. It's starting from the bottom and working up. You start from pratyaksha now. But, of course, all these things that you're working with, that you're discussing, are based on shastra. But their main focus is on pratyaksha. Okay, any questions on any of this? So we see it's a very logical system. The system of logic is very useful. It's a standard Vedic system. Everybody uses it. But the difference is that what are actually his conceptions of the soul, God, the material energy, the process of elevation, and the ultimate goal. Right? But otherwise, his technique of logic is perfect, and so that's used by everyone. Right? We also use the same system. Srila Prabhupada, quoting Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, then makes the point that the presentation of Panch Anga, that this nyaya, this logic where you present your point, then you give, you know, support for that, give examples, remove any doubts and everything, conclude everything together, and then state your, you know, come to your conclusion. Like that. Does that make sense? So you've shown how the conclusion is worked. Like we say, there's fire on the mountain, right? So that's your statement. There's fire on the mountain because there's smoke, right? And so then you have to show how smoke is connected to fire. Having shown that, you can remove any other doubt. Then your conclusion is, where there's smoke, there's fire, because there's smoke on the mountain, therefore there's fire. Does that make sense? So your first thing is exactly what you want to say. And then the conclusion is there. You're showing the mechanics of how you came about that. Because you can't show that in the first one because you haven't given the reasons and examples. Does that make sense? So they're exactly the same. Just one is with explanations and the other is just, you know, the exact point that you're making. Okay. Now, the difficulty comes in describing the soul, then it's separate from God. It's eternal. It has consciousness, you know, like that, but it doesn't actually get into the element of happiness, and that in the consciousness is also activity. Therefore, they're going to miss out on their ultimate goal, which is, they say, is impersonal liberation. Because they don't actually have activities or don't have the nature of the soul being Ananda that's based on relationship. Right? They're taking it in the negative. When there's no material disturbances, you'll be happy. Right? The world then is created, made up of so many things that is there, you know, different varieties of atoms and that make up all the different things of the universe. And it's controlled by God, created, maintained, and destroyed. But the atoms in that are eternal, and so therefore they're separate. Right? And then God, He is the supreme controller, omnipotent, and all that, but somehow or another, the material energy and the souls are actually separate from God, though God is the controller of them. Right? And then your process through analyzing and finding proper truth, you know, that you can support through the system of logic, right? That, by that, you can free yourself from all material contamination, and therefore you will exist in the liberated state. You understand? So the point that the soul has a relationship with God is not brought out. Does that make sense? And that God is the source of the soul and the material energy. So you can see here where the flaws are in their system. Because otherwise, as far as logic goes, it's very well. There's nothing more technically perfect in logic than this. You won't find another system. But logic isn't enough, because why it becomes the thing is because they're only working with logic, and through logic they can't understand God, right? As a person who He actually is. You can understand that there's some superior being there, some superior intelligence. That much you can appreciate, but you can't actually know Bhagavan. And in this case, He doesn't even really understand Paramatma. Maybe they'll accept Paramatma, I'm not sure. But they will never understand Bhagavan. Does this make sense? So, therefore, that is revealed through devotional service. So they can't see this because logic is their process. So it will always have that weakness. Yes? No? All right? Something else? Okay, then from the next system, Vaisheshika, the Vedic atomic theory. Oh, it's not so big. Vaisheshika. An analysis of the aspects of reality. The founder of Vaisheshika philosophy is the sage Kanada, who was also known as Uluka. So the system is sometimes called Aulukya. Kanada wrote the first systematic work of this philosophy, Vaisheshika Sutra. This work is divided into 10 cantos, each canto containing two sections. Prasastapada wrote a commentary on this sutra entitled Svarta Dharma Sangraha, that is so famous that it is called Bhashya, which means simply commentary. In Indian philosophical discourse, whenever the word Bhashya is used by itself without further specification, it is understood to refer to this commentary. And just like if you say Shakti, like that, then it will always mean the material energy, like Shiva's wife, Parvati Durga, right? Does that make sense? But Shakti can mean the internal potency. The Jivas are Shakti. Material energy is Shakti, but it'll always mean that if it's just on its own. Does that make sense? So in the same way as this commentary is so famous that if you just say Bhashya, it means this particular Bhashya, this commentary on Vaisheshika's work. Two well-known explications of Prasastapada's work are Udyayana Kiranavali and Sridhar's Nyaya Kandali. The significant feature of this system is the introduction of a special category of reality called uniqueness, Vishesha. Thus the system is known as Vaisheshika. So I guess the derivative from Vishesha you get Vaisheshika, means must be the philosophy of uniqueness. Vaisheshika is allied to the Nyaya system of philosophy, Both systems accept the liberation of the individual self as the end goal. Both view ignorance as the root cause of all pain and misery. And both believe that liberation is attained only through right knowledge of reality. There are, however, two major differences between Nyaya and Vaisheshika. First, Nyaya philosophy accepts four independent sources of knowledge: perception, inference, comparison, and testimony. But Vaisheshika accepts only two: perception and ignorance. So it's an inference. So that would indicate he doesn't accept authority. So you've got to get the knowledge yourself. You're not going to go by. Second, Nyaya maintains that all of reality is comprehended by 16 categories, padarthas, whereas Vaisheshika recognizes only 7 categories of reality, see table 2. These are dravya, substance, guna, quality, karma, action, samanya, generality, vishesha, uniqueness, samavaya, inheritance, abhava, non-existence. The term padartha means the object denoted by a word. And according to Vaisheshika philosophy, all objects donated by words can be broadly divided into two main classes: that which exists and that which does not exist. 6 of the 7 padarthas are in the first class, that which exists. In the second class, that which does not exist, there is only one padartha, abhava. And abhava was non-existence, okay, which stands for all negative facts such as the non-existence of things. The first two categories of reality, substance and quality, are treated in greater detail in the following discussion than are the remaining 5. Seven categories: either dravya, substance, guna, quality, karma, action, samanya, generality, inheritance. Oh, uniqueness and non-existence aren't here. That's strange.
I think they've got in the table uniqueness. They said inherence is vishesha, and up the top it says uniqueness is and then there's it's missing inherence, samavaya, and non-existence above.
Inherence vishesha. Yeah, it's got them mixed up here. Somehow or another, it didn't get put together properly, this chart, I think. So the nine dravyas that we see here: earth, water, fire, air, ether, time, direction, soul, and mind. Yeah, so in the mind, then intelligence is false ego already included. Quality, color, taste, smell, touch, sound. Okay, number, magnitude, distinctness, union, separation, remoteness, nearness, cognition, pleasure, pain, desire, aversion, effort, heaviness, fluidity, viscidity, tendency, virtue, and non-virtue. Okay? The category of substance, the 9 dravyas. Dravya, substance, is that in which a quality or an action can exist, but which in itself is different from both quality and action. Okay. Without substance, there cannot be a quality or an action, because substance is the substratum of quality and action. and it is also the material cause of the composite things produced from it. A cloth, for example, is formed by the combination of a number of threads of certain colors. The threads are the material or constitutive causes of the cloth because it is made of the threads that subsist in the cloth. Okay, in other words, you have earth, so things can be made out of earth. Right? You have water, things can be done with water, made from fire, things with fire, any combination. In other words, these elements are there, and then from that you create something. Right? You create something. So it itself is not the particular the particular quality or action. You know, in other words, what is the special specific form that it takes, or you know, the different thing and what action it can perform? It's separate from that. But without it, those things can't be performed. Does that make sense? So also, what we're getting under here is that quality and action. Is that quality is quality and action of Krishna. And the quality is which on which the action then is based, and that has a particular form that's made from that energy. Does that make sense? So therefore we see is that the Lord and his internal potency are included here. They're not understanding this. But in other words, we're saying the same thing, but they're only catching that part of it. Many of these who look at things and get into subtlety understand that there's a potency behind the form that's there. So they see, and in that they see that there's a potency that's there, a quality that's there, then there's a potency that is accomplishing that quality. Right? There's strength, the column has strength, and then there's actually the application of strength, of actually doing the work of strength. You understand? Because the work can't be done unless strength is there. So, but then you have the form that it takes. So according to the type of strength or the quantity or like here the magnitude or different things, then it has that particular form that's manifest. So many deal on these subtle levels. Does that make sense? Because when we say it simply, that there's the quality, and then there's the form that Lakshmi takes. The quality is Krishna. And then to support or to serve that quality of Krishna, Lakshmi takes a form. But that form is also doing an action. So that means the form itself, the action itself, that's Lakshmi. But the quality, then that's Krishna. Does that make sense? So she's doing all that. At the same time as she's also that elements by which these forms are made. You know what I'm saying? So in other words, how she's going to make these, put these forms together and be in control of that unless she's actually, it's non-different from her. Right? That'll be the weakness in the Nyaya philosophy. The God's the controller and all, knows everything on that, but how is he not the origin of these energies? How is he able to control these energies? Right? If there's something outside of him, how would he have the qualities to deal with them? You know what I'm saying? Because you have eyes, you can see. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. Does this make sense? So we can see is that all the points that are made in these other philosophies are there within ours, but because they stop at a certain point, that's where their weakness comes in, or the atheistic quality comes in. They're not looking at the whole picture. There are 9 kinds of substances: earth, water, fire, air, ether, time, direction, soul, and mind. The first 5 of these are called the physical elements because each of them possesses a specific quality that can be perceived by an external sense facility. Each of the senses is composed of elements whose distinguishing qualities are registered by specific sensory receptors. For example, smell is the particular property of the earth, and it is apprehended by the nostrils. Taste is the particular property of water, which is perceived by the tongue. quality is the particular property of fire and light, and it is discerned by the eyes. Touch is the particular property of air, which is experienced by the skin. And sound is the particular property of akasha, ether, which is received by the ears. It's interesting how he's using particular in each one just to point out the thing, but how it's actually gained. He uses five different synonyms for the five senses. I'm just saying that from a writing point of view. You know, how he's able to find that. So therefore, apprehended, perceived, discerned, experienced, and received. Right? So he's a very good writer. Find all those things. Paramanu. The smallest particle of earth, water, fire, and air in Vaisheshika, the smallest indivisible part of matter is called Paramanu, or atom. This is not to be confused with the modern scientific term atom, because an atom, as described in nuclear physics, is itself composed of many parts. Right? So he's talking about what's smaller than that. In other words, the Vedic concept of atom, the modern scientist still hasn't come across yet. Right? Because they're going down to that, and then they're seeing the molecules are made out of that. Nice, but they don't understand actually, you know, what is the smallest particle. Because everything is made out of that. Because an atom is the Vaisheshika usage of the word is different. It simply refers to the most minute indivisible state of matter. The atoms of earth, water, fire, and air are eternal because an atom is partless and cannot be produced or destroyed. The common elements of earth, water, fire, and air, however, are non-eternal because they are produced by combinations of atoms and therefore can disintegrate or change. Right? They're saying that the indivisible little small parts, they're eternal because they're always there. But how they're combined together so that then forms are made, any of the combinations, that is temporary. Right? So in one sense, you can say that is correct, in that the pradhan, you know, is the combination of matter. It always exists. But now it's a matter of whether it's been manifest or whether it's within the Lord or whether he expands it so it's visible. You know, just like the souls are eternal, so it's just a matter of whether they're manifest or not. You know what I'm saying? But they're always there. So they're working on this principle as eternal, but they're not necessarily understanding the whole creation and this and that. We'll see if he actually understands anything. But do we understand the difference here? So they're working on that eternality of these elements, but they don't understand there's times when they can be manifest and times when they can't be manifest. Right? But the nature of the atoms are always present. The existence of atoms is proved by inference, not by perception, in the following way. All the composite objects of the world are made up of parts. In separating the parts of a composite object, one passes from the larger to the smaller, and then from the smaller to the smallest. But when one comes to the smallest part that cannot be further divided in any way, then the process of separation has to stop. That indivisible and minutest part in Vaisheshika is called the atom. Technically, they haven't seen it. They just know it exists. So, you know, by the process of logic, you have to get to a point where it can't be divided anymore. Right? If one does not accept the concept of indivisibility, then he will commit the fallacy of infinite regression. Right? You know, infinite regression is just going to get smaller and smaller. You just go on eternally. Where does it stop? Because it has no parts, the atom cannot be said to be produced. Right? So you're going into infinite regression, but there has to be something that can't be divided. that something's built on. Does that make sense? You're going to build something, it has to be built on something. It can't be infinite regression. So there has to be something. So it has to stop at some point. But then because it has no parts, it can't be produced. Because they're looking at it, everything that's produced has parts. Therefore, it has no parts, it can't be produced. Right? Now, in one sense, you can say that's true because the soul is not produced. Material energy is not produced. Right? Spiritual energy is not produced. It's eternal. It always exists. It's just a matter of manifestation. Right? But the manifestation then therefore is made out of parts. Right? The different elements are put together and then you see something. But the difference is those manifestations within the spiritual world, then that's an eternal concept. Right? Material world, then we know everything that's created here is temporary and it does disappear. And the souls, you know, they don't actually, you don't make more parts, you don't combine them together. They themselves get attached to the material energy which is made out of parts. Right? Because they're not even working with the spiritual here because they're not accepting even authority, so how will they know about it? Right? Does that make sense? Because it has no part, the atom cannot said to be produced and it cannot be destroyed, because destruction means to break a thing down into its parts. And in an atom there are no parts. Atom therefore can be neither produced nor destroyed. They are eternal. Right? They're working from the negative. It means something with parts, you can take apart, then it's destroyed. But if something doesn't have any parts, you can't take it apart, so it can't be destroyed. Therefore, the atom is eternal. You understand? So it is through inference that they're getting at this. The whole thing is through that you have to understand is we have something that has, we have an object and it has parts. So I can break it down. Therefore, from parts, I can break it down until it won't be exist anymore. Therefore, whatever is seen that has parts, it doesn't actually exist. Right? It's temporary. Because having parts means it's temporary, and this thing is made of parts, therefore it's not. So if you look at it the other way, is that something without parts can't be broken down, right? If you can't break it down, it's not temporary, therefore it's eternal, right? Because you break down, it's temporary. You can't break it down, it should be eternal. Does that make sense? That's how their logic is working. Does that make sense what they're doing? But they don't understand it's eternal because it's God's energy and coming from the Lord. That's the point where they miss. Right? Does that make sense? In other words, we can say the same things and agree with the same things, but their conclusion is wrong. Like what Rupa Goswami is making, the point is that philosophical speculation that its end is in impersonal or voidist, how do you say it? The impersonal, the voidist, is the ultimate destination gained by the mental speculation, then that is rejected. Right? But that speculation, in other words, we're using inference and these other elements of pratyaksha to understand the authority of what is given in the shastras to support your worship of favorable worship of Krishna, then that's fine. Right? Does that make sense? So the difficulty will come is that they're using the inference, but because they actually don't know the Lord, this is then mental speculation. Right? But if the devotees are using it, then it's not, because it's in the position of using it to get to the ultimate position of service to Krishna. So understanding the material energy and how he can break it apart. And therefore, because once you break something apart, it loses its interest. Right? It means if I have, you know, a nice preparation that looks very attractive, then you become desirous or attached of it, to it. But if I go back in time and take it all apart, where, you know, I put on the counter in front of you, I put a cauliflower, a couple of potatoes, you know, a little pile of cumin seeds, you know, a cup of water, you know, and like this, some salt, and just all down the counter, are you going to be attracted to it? No, you may think, wow, why don't we put this together and cook it? But you're not going to be attached to it. Right? You may want to deal with it to make it into something you can become attached to. But you're not going to be attached to it. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the whole point of these philosophies, is you break it down, especially this. You break it down into elements that it can't even be recognized anymore. So therefore you won't have any a really specific attraction for it. Okay? So then we'll stop here, and then tomorrow we'll start with the definition of Akash. Saying atoms are eternal because they can't be broken apart. Therefore, things that are broken apart are temporary. What you can't break apart is eternal.
But God is separate from his atoms.
In here, we haven't come across God yet. What I'm explaining is a connection to our philosophy that we will agree that it's eternal because it's one of God's energies, but its manifestation, where you can appreciate it, that's temporary. But that doesn't necessarily seem to be brought into play here. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai.